Now, I am not one of those people who believes that the moon is a stepping stone to Mars. I don't think the moon is a stepping stone to Mars. We don't need to go back to the moon to go to Mars. The moon is not a good place to launch Mars missions from. The rocket propulsion requirements to go from low Earth orbit to the surface of the moon are actually greater than those to go from low Earth orbit to the surface of Mars. That's because Mars has got an atmosphere, so you can use a parachute to help you land, whereas the moon, it all has to be done with rockets. Okay? And so even if there was rocket fuel sitting on the moon right now and available for free, and I can guarantee you if there was a lunar base, rocket fuel would not be free. But if it was, it still wouldn't make any sense to go there to refuel on your way to Mars, because it's easier just to go straight to Mars. So the moon is not a good base for going to Mars. However, the moon is a good place to do certain things that have nothing to do with Mars. In particular, astronomy. The moon is seismically dead. It has no atmosphere. It has a very slow rotation rate. It's an ideal place to put optical interferometers, arrays of telescopes that work together to create a much higher resolution than you can get from any single telescope. And it just makes sense that if you want to accomplish two different objectives in space and you want to do it at minimum cost, the best way to do it is to develop a set of hardware that can accomplish both objectives. And while I won't go into it here because, you know, it's already been a long talk and this is a talk in itself, I'll simply assert without proof that we can use the Mars Direct hardware to also build lunar bases. So, this is the primary set of tools that is needed to establish humanity on two new worlds, on the moon and Mars. No giant interplanetary spaceships, no floating interplanetary spaceports, just a good booster with a good throw stage and two fundamental payload elements that can be sent to either the moon or Mars. A habitat module to use on either the moon or Mars, although you got to insulate it differently because it's a different thermal environment, and then a Earth return vehicle to use to come back from the moon and Mars. From Mars, you need two stages to come back because it takes more push to come back from Mars than from the moon, and from the moon, one stage. And then you have an aeroshell module that you use at Mars. You would not want to use an aeroshell on the moon unless it was made in a politically influential district, in which case you might. But, you know, you can use your own costing mechanism that you have in the back of your mind, and you'll probably hit it at least as close as the government analysts with their Cray computers. But this is not a $400 billion procurement here. Okay, this, what you're looking at here, if it was done by the traditional high-cost, high-overhead, fat cat aerospace industry, like my former employer, would be around a $20 billion procurement to develop all this hardware. And then each Mars mission by the copy would cost around $2 billion, and each lunar mission about $1 billion. So if we did this program over 20 years, in which the first 10 years we develop all the hardware, and during the second 10 years we sent 5 missions to Mars and 10 to the moon, you're talking about $40 billion, which is around $2 billion a year, which is about 15% of NASA's budget, or around 2/3 of 1% of the U.S. military budget. Or put another way, if we did this as an international program, incorporating the United States, Australia, Japan, Europe, Canada, the Western countries, okay, it would cost around 4 cents a week for every person in all the participating country. 4 pennies, count them, a week. It's a very small price to pay for a new world. Now, one of the reasons, well, look, I believe that we are standing at a point of great opportunity right now, which therefore is also therefore a point of crisis. In that, I mean, look, I've just showed you this plan. I've walked you through it. And while there are plenty of hardware elements here that we do not currently possess, there is no technology in this hardware that we do not currently possess. There is nothing here that if it was not put up for bid by the government, that major aerospace contractors would not offer to build within 3 or 4 years for some specified price or some other similar arrangement. In other words, we have the technology to go to Mars. In other words, we are much, much better prepared today to send people to Mars than we were to send people to the moon in 1961 when Kennedy started the moon program and we were there 8 years later. We are better prepared technologically. We're also better prepared scientifically. We know much more about Mars than they knew about the moon. We are better prepared financially. I mean, this is a problem of lower technological order and therefore lower cost than Apollo was, but we have a much bigger material base to do it with. The United States alone today has 3 times the gross national product in real dollars that it had in 1961. In fact, Japan today has a larger economy than the United States had in 1961. Okay? And if we're talking about doing this with the Western nations working together, we're talking about doing this with 10 times the material base that was available to support the Apollo program. And we are better prepared militarily. What do I mean by that? In 1961, the West faced a global military opponent of terrifying proportions. In 1961, it was possible for people to say, and they did say, why are we wasting all this money sending people to the moon when we should be building atomic bombs? You don't hear that much anymore. We don't need to build more atomic bombs. We don't need to build more nuclear submarines or bombers or guided missiles. Okay, we have no global military opponent. And all the sorts of resources and the sorts of technically skilled people that needed to be devoted to those objectives at that time, they don't have to be devoted to those objectives. They can be devoted to objectives like this. Okay, and we only need a tiny, tiny fraction of them to do it. Okay, and we're better prepared socially. I mean, look, we have social problems. There are social problems in every advanced sector country, in the United States, Australia, Europe, you name it. But they do not compare. They do not remotely compare to those that we had in the 1960s, not by a long shot. So in every way, we are vastly better prepared today to do this than we were to do that. In fact, it can be safely said that we are vastly better prepared today to launch a great new age of exploration than any society has ever been in all of human history. So this is an opportunity, and you need to seize opportunities. You need to seize the time, because you don't know how long an opportunity is going to last. And it's uniquely an opportunity now because also we have this other thing, the turn of the millennium, which makes this time pregnant with symbolism for grand new beginnings. Okay, and so we need to seize the opportunity. And I'm not the only person that thinks that. There's a lot of people who agree with me that we ought to do this who also think that. We, the old members of the old Mars Underground, and appreciating this and various other facts, such as the public response to the Pathfinder mission, where 100 million people hit the NASA Mars website in 1 day, okay? Just in my case, my response to my book, The Case for Mars, I got 4,000 letters from people that read that book. I have gotten 4,000 letters. Imagine yourself getting 4,000 letters. Okay, I got them, okay? And they come from all over the world, and in one way or another, they basically all say the same thing, which is, how do we make this happen? There are people all over the world that want to make this happen. And because of these things and other things, what happened was a bunch of us folks who want to make this happen decided to form an organization to make it happen called the Mars Society, okay? Because things happen because people make them happen. That's how history works, okay? So we formed an organization. We called a founding meeting. It was held in Boulder, Colorado in August 98. 700 people showed up from all over the world, including like around 10 from Australia. And we set up an organization. We now have 80 chapters around the world, including one here. And we're trying to make this happen. How are we trying to make it happen? Through a number of means. First of all, direct public outreach, speeches like this to spread the vision of humans pioneering Mars, and also public outreach through other means which potentially could be far more potent. For instance, some of the people that have joined the Mars Society are pretty influential people, like James Cameron, the filmmaker. He did the movie Titanic. He's a member of the Mars Society, and he is now making an IMAX movie about the first human mission to Mars, and also a TV miniseries, and I'm consulting with him on that. And we think this is going to help reach millions of people, perhaps tens or, of millions of people. What else are we doing? Direct political work, attempting to reach the political class directly. We have already had some success in this. In the United States, last year, we reversed a $1 billion cut in NASA's planetary exploration budget that was attempted to be put through by a bunch of lunatics in the House Appropriations Committee, and we stopped that. We reversed it. It took 4 months of hard work to reverse that, but we did. In Europe, we stopped Germany from pulling out of the Mars Express mission, which was is Europe's first interplanetary probe. And if Germany had done that, that would have canceled the mission, and we were able to prevent that. And we're briefing all the people running for president and their honchos and their consultants and their astrologers and all these people that control them to try to get this idea into their minds. And it's, you know, what we need to do here, okay, we need to start talking to the political class here. I know you think that's hopeless. I know you think politicians are stupid. They are. Okay, okay. You are not unique in that respect. Let me assure you. Okay, they are dumb in the U.S. too. Okay. However, we have a space program. Okay, and you could have one too. You know the Pathfinder mission. Pathfinder mission cost $150 million. Australia could afford that. That's not much. That's the cost of a shopping mall. That's the cost of a movie. Australia could afford to do missions like that. Okay, you could afford to do missions like that one every other year. Okay, have an Australian space probe going to Mars. Okay, and you should. It's a shame that you don't. It's in fact a scandal that you don't. It's a scandal that for the past 30 years, the government here has told talented young people, you want to explore space, emigrate. Okay, you know, that's wrong. And it shouldn't be. The exploration of the solar system is going to be the cutting-edge task of the human race in the 21st century, and Australians should be part of it. But you have to make that happen. And then finally, we're doing a series of private projects of our own. Okay, we want to become kind of like the Jacques Cousteau Society of Mars. Okay, you know, Cousteau wanted to explore the oceans. And initially, he didn't have much resources. So what did he do? Well, he did what he could. He put on his aqualung, he went underwater, he went around in a coral reef, made a movie, came up and showed it to people. At that time, no one had ever seen anything like this. I said, wow, that's what life is like underwater. That's incredible, Jacques. What do you want to do next? And he said, well, what I want to do next is I want to go deep, but for that, I'll need a miniature submarine, and that's going to cost $5 million. But by then, he has some credibility, and he can raise $5 million, and he can do the next project. And so he does that, and they publicize that, and that gives him more credibility, and he can do another project in order of magnitude more involved. Well, similarly, look, 100 million people hit that blasted Pathfinder website. Okay, at $2 each, you're going to fund another Pathfinder mission. At $100 each, you could have sent humans to Mars if you did it in the private sector. Now, I'm not saying that you could raise $10 billion by charging $100 admission to a website. That wouldn't work. Okay, I'm not claiming that. Okay, but what I am saying is that the number of people around the world who are enthusiastic and who believe in the human expansion into space is sufficient to easily fund right out of their private pockets as a minor discretionary expenditure the actual human exploration of Mars and even colonization, provided they can be rallied. So in other words, if you're thinking about privately funded exploration of Mars, it's not really a material question, it's a moral question. And by moral, I don't mean in the sense of right and wrong, I mean in the sense of morale. Okay? It's a question of rallying the morale of those who believe in order to make it happen. Well, how can you do that? I mean, look, if I just went on the radio tomorrow and said, everybody send in $100 and we'll have $10 billion and we'll go to Mars, most people would regard it as a scam. Although, perhaps I should try. Could have interesting results. But but I don't think it would work. So what are we going to do? We're going to do the Cousteau approach. We're going to start small. And so what we've decided to do is, as our first project, to do not a $10 billion project, but a $1 million project, which is the establishment of a simulated human Mars exploration base in the Canadian Arctic on Devon Island. Devon Island, 75 degrees north, it's 900 miles from the North Pole. It's a polar desert with a meteorite impact crater in it that has created geology extremely similar to that of Mars. And in fact, NASA scientists have been up there for the past several summers exploring it in order to explore Mars by comparison. Well, what we're going to do is establish a simulated human Mars exploration base there to actually conduct field exploration under the same constraints that a human Mars exploration crew would do, and thus learn how to develop the tactics and techniques required for field exploration in this kind of environment. There's an awful lot you can learn by trying to do this. Now, this project is real. We've already raised more than half the money. The thing is under construction right now in a factory in Denver. We're going to deploy it on Devon Island this summer. It will operate for just a few weeks this summer, but then next summer we'll operate for a full field season, and beyond that we're going to push out 3 months, 4 months, 6 months into the Arctic spring and fall, which are quite severe. But winter is not possible. So this is underway now. And as an adjunct to this, we have just decided to start an additional project, which is to develop a pressurized rover analog. Okay, and we're inviting Mars Society chapters from around the world and others who want to participate to present designs for a pressurized rover analog at our conference. We're having our international conference in Toronto, August 10th through 13th. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump from here. You're all invited. Just come on over. If you want to find out, we've got a website at marssociety.org. It'll tell you about it. But anyway, people to present designs there, and then we're going to fund one or more of them and operate them in Mars analog environments, which include not only the Arctic, but also desert environments in North America and Australia. Because you may know that Australia has certain desert environments here that in certain respects are very good Mars analogs. Obviously, they're not cold like Devon Island, but the quality of the terrain is very similar to that of Mars, and more importantly, the kind of fossils that are there of bacteria, paleobacteria, exactly the sort of thing that we would be looking for on Mars can be found there. And the idea is to put a crew through the paces of actually doing that kind of field work for real, once again, within the constraints. The whole point of the exercise is this. In other words, look, if you have a Mars mission, you have a variety of arms, so to speak, available to you. You have a pressurized rover. You have people in unpressurized light vehicles like ATVs. You have pedestrian astronauts. You have robots. You have orbital data. You have the crew at the Mars base. You have the people at mission control. You have the terrestrial scientific community. These are your combination of assets with various strengths and weaknesses that you need to combine and make work together in symphony. And that is the kind of thing that we're going to try to work out. And we intend to do some of it here. So perhaps some of you will want to get involved in that project. So I'm going to wind up. I'm going to wind up with a quote that I lifted from a book called A Plymouth Plantation. This book was written in 1621 by William Bradford. Bradford was a leader of a group of people who are very famous in American history called the Pilgrims. The Pilgrims were religious refugees from England who first left England for Holland and then eventually for Massachusetts, or what is now Massachusetts. That is, they were the first colonists of New England. And what he's writing about here is the history of the Pilgrims. And what he is writing about is when they were in Holland, and they didn't like what was happening to them there, and they didn't know what to do about it. And what happened was one guy came up with this totally bizarre suggestion that what they ought to do about it was relocate the entire congregation from the civilized Netherlands into the wilds of North America. Because there, as harsh as it might be, there they could cut their own path, there they could make their own world. And he says the following. He says, this proposition, relocation to America, being made public and coming to the scanning of all, it raised many variable opinions amongst men and caused many fears and doubts amongst themselves. Some, from their reasons and hopes conceived, labor to stir up and encourage the rest to undertake and prosecute the same. Others, again, out of their fears, objected against it and sought to divert from it, alleging many things, and those neither unreasonable nor improbable, as that it was a great design and subject to many unconceivable perils and dangers. It was answered that all great and honorable actions are accompanied with great difficulties and must be both enterprised and overcome with answerable courages. And I put that up there because it's got to be understood that that and nothing less than that was the kind of sheer moxie that it took to establish European civilization in North America in the first place. And that and nothing less than that is going to be the kind of spirit that is required to establish humanity on our new world, on Mars. Okay? But, because look, you know, I just showed you this plan. And despite the fact that it is by far the cheapest Mars mission plan that has ever been seriously proposed, it is also, in my view, the safest. The reason why I think it is the safest is because the relatively small vessels involved can be completely integrated on the ground at the Cape, where you have vastly greater quality control than you could ever have with on-orbit assembly of giant complex spacecraft. And we have two complete Earth return vehicles to get the crew home, and we have a four-layer defense in depth on the mission, and we have artificial gravity on the way out and a solar flare storm shelter. But look, it is true that if you look at this plan in detail, there is no question about it, and I am not trying to conceal this, but this is a very risky plan. Okay? It's a very risky plan. And it's going to be risky when we go to Mars the first time. And that is going to be true whether we do it my way in 2007 or whether we just abdicate historical responsibility altogether and leave it to some far future civilization to do in 3007. But if you look at human history, and I don't care when you look, whether you're talking about 1621 or 1944 or 1969 or any other time, one thing is perfectly clear. And that is that nothing great has ever been accomplished without courage. Thank you.